This podcast is a Majestic Giraffe production. For more information and more content, visit majesticgiraffe.com.
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
Keep saying, you know, it's all Aaron's fault that we're here right now. What happens is when one of our authors requests something, we try to make it happen. So when they said, hey, this could be a really fun panel, we said, sure, absolutely. So we're not going to take any of your time. I'm just going to turn it over to these gentlemen whom I'm pretty sure you all know. Yeah.
Don't knock yourself out. You're the senior guy. You were here first.
Yeah. The name of this panel, and this is Aaron's fault, is Conspiring for Fun and Profit. We have done some conspiring, some strange stuff through the books, through the years. Not quite collaborations, blindly stealing from each other. Giving stuff to each other, for, you know, leaving it by the front door, you know, ringing the bell and running away. Yes. We've done that. Various anthologies and such. So I don't know where we want to start with this. Well, you want to start with the history?
Well, I think a couple of things. This is sort of an outgrowth of we had a conversation at Origins, and Aaron and I teach a lot of how to write classes, and Tim has joined us here at DragonCon. Both at Origins and DragonCon, and a lot of one of the questions that we get asked is, what about collaborations? How does this work? And so we thought this panel would be a good one where we could talk about different things. For example, you know, Tim and I have collaborated in terms of outlining stories together and then breaking into parts and writing it. I work with Brian Polito in writing screenplays, and that's an entirely different process. And so we just wanted to talk about that sort of in general, because sometimes with the process you're working side by side, and other times it's entirely remote. Do you want to talk about, like, the first time that you and I switched some chapters back and forth when we were doing Star Wars books?
This back when you were doing the X-Wings?
Yeah.
He had a scene where he needed, or he wanted to use, I think this was the destruction of the Exarchoon's. No, that was his. Talon Card,
yeah,
and Booster Tarek, yeah. And he wanted to use Card, and called me up to say, I'd like to use this character. Is that okay? And told me what he wanted to do with him. And I said, sounds okay. You know, fire me off the dialogue and everything. I'll see if it works okay, and see if this sounds like Card would, the way he would talk. And so Mike did that, and out of a couple of pages, I think I asked for three words to be changed, something like that.
Right, and Tim had turned around and used a couple of used Tycho out of Rogue Squadron in one of the scenes that he was working on, and so sort of we had a hostage exchange, and we're both reading this stuff, and you know, so he wants three words changed, and I'm looking at it going, yeah, out of this dialogue is about three words I want changed.
About that,
so so we had a really good idea, or you know, our styles were very, very compatible in that sense, that they flowed pretty well back and forth.
Part of the thing is that the three of us have a particular view of how the Star Wars universe works. The Alston's tackpoles on axis or something, and it is not necessarily how other authors envision the feel for this universe. And so you will typically, if you like my stuff, you'll like their stuff. You like their stuff, you like my stuff. You like somebody else. It's a toss-up whether you like ours or not.
Yeah.
But we're a pretty good gauge of how we think Star Wars should be done. And so, you know, that tends to mean that when we create characters, we create them. If I understand my character and Mike understands Star Wars the way I do, he'll get my character as well. This is one reason the only characters I've ever really had on stage have been Mike's, usually for cameos, and then Kel Tanner, Aaron's, who graciously lent me to lent him to me for Scoundrels. Reminded of the old, you know, some of the old movies in the 40s, so-and-so appears courtesy of the studio that owns their soul, or something of that sort.
Aaron D. Selznick.
Yeah, right. So that was how it started out, and we went on from there. We're going to go on that. You want to talk about the X-Wing Race Squadron stuff? Or
yeah. Like you began it.
Well, what was interesting about the X-Wing and Race Squadron tossing things back and forth is I had done the X-Wing books. Bantam talked Lucasfilm into allowing me to do iJedi, which was going to be a hardback and meant that I wasn't going to have the time to do any more, or at least they wanted another trilogy, or they wanted four more X-Wing books. They wanted to give me one. They needed someone else to write the other three. And so Tom Dupree, who was the editor at the time, and I conspired for where the other three books ought to be set in that sequence, that, you know, Hobby and Jansen, who I wasn't using, should be picked up. And I didn't use Hobby and Jansen because in Rogue Squadron, I wanted to be able to kill everybody except for Wedge if we needed to. And so if I had Hobby and Jansen, we knew they weren't going to die. Because they got used in later books. So we farmed them out in Rogue Squadron. We said they're off doing another training squadron. So that was the image of, that was the thought that I had in talking with Tom, that Aaron would then go ahead and use Hobby and Jansen as the core of what he was going to do. And this was a brilliant plan, because Tom had told me that he was going to use Aaron. Only Tom had not told Aaron he was going to use Aaron. And this is, I remember after, you know, Tom had told me that we had talked, and Tom says to me, he says, you cannot say a word to Aaron until we get all the contracts ironed out. And it must have been 9 months later, I finally get a call from Aaron going, so what's this about these X-Wing books that I'm doing? And I don't know if Aaron remembers it this way, but I remember saying to him, I have been waiting 9 months for this phone call. and we talked through, just in general terms, you know, what I had learned from my experience of what the fans were interested in, what people really liked and excited. So I just kind of gave him an overview of this is sort of what the landscape is. And then, as all you know, Aaron just took hold and ran with it.
Yeah, there's more to it than that. Is everybody hearing me? It sounds a little dim to me.
Here, you want this?
Of course. Yeah, that's better. The thing was, when I got to the project, it was actually months. I was in 4 months after everything had been decided. I was suddenly months late, even though I hadn't even heard about it the day before. And that's actually kind of a terrifying prospect. But the whole plan for me to use Hobby and Jansen as the leaders of the new squadron went out the window, because Bantam at that point, under Pat Labuda, told me, no, all the series has to deal with Wedge Antilles. He has to be in charge. And so not only was I not doing exactly what had been kind of plotted out for me, I had to shoehorn some extra Wedge time into a timeline where his efforts had pretty much already been locked down. I had this, you know, this few months period from the end of the last Rogue Squadron novel to the start of the new one, and to the series of events that appears in Courtship of Princess Leia and so forth, in which I had to fit things. So I used Wedge and Jansen. And when we had that conversation, I do remember the I've been waiting 9 months comment. But my discussion in my head started basically with and then I actually got around to coherent words and said, well, you know, I knew I could probably hit the ground running, but I needed a little direction, and I said, so what do you think I should do? Tried to sound cool. What do you think I should do? And Mike said, well, we do need to wrap up the story of Warlord Zinj prior to Courtship of Princess Leia. And my two pieces of advice are, first, if you're going to create a new squadron, give them a cool name. And second, try to inject some humor. The fans really like that. I think on that last part, I think I did okay.
Is that the only part you heard, remember, from that conversation? Humor, got it.
Other than, Yeah.
Yeah, to Aaron's credit, he was not hyperventilating too bad on the phone, okay? So
I think our next collaboration was it the four-part stories for the Adventure Journal, or was it Jedi stuff?
That was certainly the more formal thing. You want to talk about how we did that? Because the iJedi collaboration was just weird.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to think where in the timeline all this goes. Since you would use Card and Booster, you should probably mention how you snuck in Booster's Star Destroyer.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good one. So here's one of the weird things, and don't anybody breathe word. Well, it doesn't matter. It's all Disney now, so it doesn't matter. When Lucasfilm was approving stuff, there were two levels of approval. There was the guy who would approve comics, and I was doing the X-Wing comics at the time. And then there were the people that would approve the novels. And when I was writing the books, I would put footnotes in to say, this is the source material, this is where I drew this. Or if I didn't have an actual source, like in Isard's Revenge, I needed a shoulder-mounted anti-aircraft missile. And in the West End game stuff, they had like an SA-1 and an SA-3, and what I needed would be right in the middle, so I invented the SA-2. And my little footnote said, I'm inventing the SA-2 because it's right in the middle of these things. You know, hope you approve this. And Lucasfilm always did. Well, as Tim is plotting out, I think it was only Spectre. Had you been split into two yet?
I don't think it had. It was still The Hand of Thrawn. It was going to be one book.
Huh. Right. Yeah. So you knew in the end that you needed a Star Destroyer that you were going to rip to pieces, okay? And I'm coming down and I'm doing the Back to War, and one of the things that I want to do is to give Booster a Star Destroyer and have him pilot the Star Destroyer around at least for the end of that book. But because I knew you needed it, my footnote in there was, I'm giving this to Booster because Tim will use it later.
To clarify, I didn't need it, but it would be cool to have. That he told them that.
No, and Tom Dupree gave me a call and said, "Hey, you're giving this guy the thing because Tim's going to use it." I said, "Absolutely." That is, you know, I'm trying to make it sound like that is the only reason I'm doing that. This is not. You know, I'm not having fun with this at all. Yes, it's perfectly workmanship. You know. Because the idea of giving a thief a war machine to run around the galaxy with, not really a good idea. But they said, okay, that's fine, we'll do that. And so for approximately 15 years, Booster gets to run around, and then we get to use the Errant Venture and have that show up again in iJedi and those things.
But 2 points, we did then, or I did, when I took it over, I did the logical consequence of this thing, namely a mile-long ship under the control of a small group is going to be falling apart like crazy because you don't have the guys to maintain it.
Right.
And so it was falling apart and all that. But the arrogance, our arrogance does have bounds. Tell them what you wanted to name this ship.
Oh, yeah. Well, look. Booster, this literally went into the footnote. I named the ship the Errant Venture. But Booster is a businessman. He's turning this into a commercial venture. Really, the ship should have been named Enterprise. But I figured LFL would probably say no, but that was in the footnote. And I got a call from Sue Stoney going, yeah, we can't use that. So Errant Venture it was. The upshot, which was real funny, so Tim shoots me out of vision. He shoots me the chapter where Booster and Talon Card are, where Talon Card is basically explaining to Booster how he's going to rip the hell out of his ship. And Booster extracts this promise that he will, that it will be totally refurbed. And the only thing that I asked Tim to add was that Booster would demand that it would be painted some other color than white. Because I figured in those 15 years, Booster, being cheap as he is, would have had to keep it painted, and it would be Star Destroyer white, because that is the only paint you can get cheaply enough to paint a Star Destroyer. So, you know, it was going to be something else. Well, when I started doing the when I was doing the Union comic, The Marriage of Luke and Mara, I was at San Diego Comic-Con, ran into the artist who knew the colorist. He took me over with the colorist. They're showing me pages and stuff like that. And there's an external shot of the Errant Venture right after Vision of the Future. And I said to the colorist, I said, look, one thing you have to do, the front end of this ship, you have to be painting it red. And so if you look at that panel in the Union comic, the only external shot you see of the Errant Venture, the nose is slowly being painted fire engine red. So it's that sort of, and that's totally ex officio. I mean, you know, there was no Lucasfilm saying, yes, you can do this. But just to Lucasfilm's credit, they were very, very cool. They allowed us to do a lot of things. As I've said before, they allowed me to do things I would not have let me get away with. So.
And just one more final on that one, not being willing to let it go quite at that. All of my classic era Star Wars books begin with a Star Destroyer because that's how the classic movies begin. So in Survivor's Quest, we have the captain standing on the bridge of the Star Destroyer, gazing out upon the nose and thinking how this used to, you know, strike fear and terror into peoples all over the galaxy, though probably not as much when it's painted red. And that's your first indication, this is Booster Tarek on the bridge, and this is the Errant Venture.
There you go.
And I got to utilize, you know, stuff that was set up by the two of them in Union Comic, especially with the last book for 13 years of the X-Wing series, where what happened was a novel that was scheduled for the Star Wars line to appear in 1999 would have been the last novel of the Bantam contract before it went to Del Rey, got canceled. And Bantam came to me and said, okay, would you like to do another Star Wars book? I said, yeah. And they said, well, what do you want to do? And I went, I said, well, I've got two ideas. I'd like to do either a novel about Luke and Leia and Han in the early days of their marriage, where Han is actually kind of coming to grips with being the less politically significant person in a very high profile relationship,
or as Aaron put it,
or a final novel in the X-Wing series involving Wedge, and after a night of consideration, I said I want to do a Wedge Antilles novel. It won't necessarily be Rogue Squadron or Waste Squadron, but a Wedge Antilles novel. And I said, and because in the Union comic book, Mike Stackpole had it set up that Wedge was a few years later married to Yellow Asiri and had two children, I want to set up that relationship. And they said, oh, it's already set up? Okay. And I said, score.
Okay, so there's a little bit of background that you have to understand about this.
There's more to it. There's more to everything.
There's more to everything. Okay. So when I was doing, when I was writing the X-Wing books, when I was writing Wedge's Gamble, Iella, Corrin's partner, shows up, and she and Wedge are kind of hitting it off. And I figured, you know, I'll set up a little romance, a little love story going there, and that's great. And I turned in Wedge's Gamble, and I saw Kevin J. Anderson at a convention. And Kevin says, you know, we're talking about the stuff that we're writing, and Kevin says, oh, by the way, I just gave Wedge the love of his life. And I'm like going, great. And that book is about 3-4 years after where I am in the universe, which means, of course, that either Iella has got to die, and I didn't want to kill her, or, you know, I can't do anything with the romance. I can't have any, you know, there's going to be nothing interesting going on, which is why in the Krytos trap, you know, Wedge shows up on her doorstep. He's going to ask her out, but he's trying to be cool. You know, it's not really going to be a date, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She says hi, invites him in, and introduces him to her husband. You know, which immediately says, sure, you know, the sparks are there, but the romance has to be put on hold because this is that sort of situation, and those are who those characters are. But I think neither Tim nor I nor Aaron, I'll assert, we're really comfortable with Wedge having a romance with this alien bird person.
Yeah.
It just didn't, it. He's not the nesting type.
She was just a feather in his cap.
Right, he's not the kind of guy to be henpecked. I mean, it's just not, so it wasn't going to be right. So when we were, Tim and I did a signing up in Seattle at Wizard of the Coast, had a big gaming center. We did a signing there, and a woman who was a diehard Wedge fan showed up, and she had 5 pages of notes to convince us why Wedge and Queezux should not get together. And she was
preacher
very,
choir.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. and it was great because I had some email from her, and so we were prepped. We knew what was going to happen, and so we sat there and we listened to her, and we said, yeah, great idea. And she was stunned. It was like she was not having to fight at all. But now we had to get Lucasfilm to do this, and so part of what was going on, and part of the reason that the Union comics got written. Oh, was because another series that we wanted to do that was supposed to tie, it was supposed to bridge Shadow and Vision. There was supposed to be a comic series, which no one had told Tim to leave any space in between those books.
I gave you 6 hours. What did you want?
I know, and I had 6 issues. I mean, yeah, what more did I need? Yeah.
Seriously, they didn't tell me a word about this, or I would have given him some space.
Right, and I plotted out this 6-issue miniseries. Which would go in depth on one planet to reflect what was going on in Tim's books across the galaxy. But they bounced that idea. Lucasfilm didn't like that idea, so they said no. And the amount of time it took them to bounce it, suddenly we didn't have 6 issues anymore. We only had 4. And I said, well, let's do the Union comic. But now this is our shot to get Wedge married off and to have children. So I ended up doing a 5-page white paper to explain why we must allow Wedge to be married, because otherwise the only people who get laid in this universe are Jedi. And after due consideration, they said okay. And so we were able to slip that in, and then Aaron was able to then use it to really good effect to get rid of Queezux finally. So this was a plan that took, 3 years to become operational, but little by slowly, we were fixing things as we went. Yeah.
And to be fair, when we're spackling, which is the process of retconning in the Star Wars universe, you can't just dismiss or express as a mistake material that has come before, even if you disagree with it somewhat. So when I was doing Starfighters of Adumar, I needed to bring Wedge to a renewal of his relationship and a furthering of his relationship with Yela. But I couldn't exactly say, this thing with Queezux was just wrong. So what I had to do is go back into his mental profile and look at what he had been doing. His appearance in the Jedi Academy trilogy was a little odd because he had gotten away from piloting and from commanding pilot squadrons to doing essentially what amounted to civic renewal on Coruscant. And I said, well, what the hell does this mean? And to me, it meant that he was suffering a sort of crisis of identity. He was looking for himself, and just being a pilot was not enough. He was trying to build for the future. His construction work was building perhaps a new life, trying to find himself. Who knew what the hell it was? So when I took him into Starfighters of Adumar, I demonstrated that he was kind of at loose ends, trying to identify and define his future, and that his relationship with Queezux was not a mistake, but what it was a sort of a trial relationship. It was him really embarking on his first serious relationship, even though it was doomed by the fact they were very different people. They benefited from one another, but they were not destined to be with one another. And so the psychology of this was a very strong part of what was going on with him in the course of Starfighters of Adumar. And then I could get him together, growing together with Yela, and then get them to the point in Union where they had 2 kids together. And of course, those 2 kids, Sile and Miri, have been increasingly important players in the later series of the Star Wars universe.
This is a good example of why we think similarly in Star Wars. A lot of the interspecies thing, that's very Star Trek. They do that all the time. It doesn't make any sense. The why do people do this? We want to find reasons, because in the real world, there are reasons for why people do things, even if it's temporary insanity or I'm on the rebound or something. Yeah. But there are reasons, and they're plausible, and they make sense for the character. We think of consequences. I think you call it consequence testing. Yeah, yeah. And that is, an important part of any novel, whether it's, you know, our own or Star Wars or something else, how are people really going to behave? How is the universe going to behave back at them? Yeah. And this is part of how we see Star Wars. It all has to make sense. It all has to feel real.
And how we see, you know, lots of other series as well. I mean, we get together at conventions, and we're not talking about business. We talk about, you know, other potential projects, and the shared sensibilities that we have allow us to come up with ideas that, if, even if they're not used at that time, go in a bank, and later on we can drag them out and perhaps elaborate them and perhaps deal with them. So it's not just our working together in Star Wars, it's working together in any other possible project.
Yeah, the problem being, of course, we don't always overlap. I mean, Aaron and I have both done Terminator books. Mike hasn't. You two have done game-related stuff. I haven't.
We've all done
Star Wars, but you know, if you do something like that off book, you know, the mouse sends over larger men in mouse suits, and they beat you senseless.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, nowadays, especially with digital publishing and the way publishing is changing, you know, one of the projects that because of this convention Origins, which is a gaming convention held in the middle of June in Columbus, the writers program that we have there, the program is called the Library, and I help run it. But when we bring authors in to teach classes and to be there to sell books and to just be there for the gamers and fans to meet. Every year the library does a limited edition anthology. And this year, for example, the theme was heroes. And so each of us ended up writing a story about heroes. And that's, you know, ends up being a, I mean, Aaron and I both did, you know, superhero stories. This ends up becoming, you know, a collaboration by theme.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
our characters weren't set in the same universe, though they probably could have been. But, you know, you get that same sensibility. So
you got the superhero vibe from both of us.
Yeah, exactly. And so now, and the nice thing about that, you know, in the olden days, only through working in the same universe was it convenient for us to collaborate.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if we were just going to collaborate all by ourselves, we'd have to figure out whose agent was going to handle it.
Yeah.
Which publisher was going to handle it. But now, because of the digital stuff, we can do this all ourselves.
And it doesn't have to be in the same universe. I mean, we could have a similar theme or a single shared character who crosses across universes and binds stories together, so we could collaborate in a sense, even though we're dealing with totally different environments.
You know, it's kind of funny, actually, because the one story that is also a lot of fun to tell, when I was doing the X-Wing comics, I remember it was while I was doing iJedi, I had to do comics sort of fill in the middle. And I remember Tim called one day and just asked me a question about something to make sure we had a fact that clicked back and forth. And he said, "So what have you done today?" And I said, "Oh, hey, I just created the best Imperial pilot ever." Because that was the day that I'd created Baron Fell. And Tim's immediate response was, "Yeah, I can use him." And so for the next 45 minutes on the phone, we literally came up with the career of Baron Fell from day one through where Tim was going to use him. And, you know, and I typed up the bio, sent it off to Tim, and it was this total, ex officio thing. We were the only guys who were writing Baron Fell. We were working off of this unofficial bio. You know, later on, I was up at Skywalker Ranch and said to Sue Rostoni, I said, "By the way, I don't know if you want this, but, you know, here's the bio we've been working on." And it was like, yes, you know, and so suddenly that became official. But, you know, one of the cool things that we could do, you know, in terms of a collaboration is we could sit down and, you know, come up with a villain, mm-hmm. and all of us in our own little worlds could end up, you know, having to deal with that villain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Baron Fell's an interesting case because Mike talks about us creating, you know, his backstory. Really, it was you doing most of it. You had the vision. All I wanted was, I need a bunch of clones that Thrawn has put down here waiting for the invasion, so when the invasion line passes, we have a fifth column ready to go and tear up their supply lines and backside. So, but I want these guys to be really not wanting to fight anymore. They just want to stay here and farm. So can you have Baron Fell be, you know, kind of a child of the soil, that he grew up on a farm or something? And in about, you know, the first five panels of the story of Baron Fell, you got him working on the farm, and that was perfect. That's all mm-hmm. I needed. And again, another logical sort of thread. We've got this hotshot Imperial pilot. No matter what happens to him, when Thrawn's got his cloning tanks going, he will clone this guy and find some use. Well, that's what the use was. And the only thing that would have made it perfect is if that had actually been used in the Yuuzhan Vong invasion thing, and I think everybody forgot about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's kind of like the line from The Godfather. Whenever I ever refused you an accommodation, you know, yeah. We make these accommodations all the time, and it's fun.
So
right now, of course, we're not collaborating on much of anything because everything is on a hiatus with the Disney takeover of the fiction.
We actually had an idea at one point for a three-part Star Wars.
Yeah.
Was it triptych?
Triple threat.
Triple threat.
What did you? But it's you called it a braided novel.
Braided novel.
Where the three parts would work together, and we'd worked out characters, and then the mouse bought Lucasfilm, and as Aaron says, everything's on hold until they decide what they want to do with the book line. I think Shelley was mildly interested, but again, everything happened before, so we don't know if they're ever going to get more books or what's going to happen with that. But that was our closest shot, I think, to doing anything.
Well, you know, we don't have to wait for the Disney dust to settle. We could use this structure, the braided novel idea, and do something independent to, you know, tide us over and give us pizza money until Star Wars comes out.
Yeah, that would be kind of nice.
What
would we do? Would it be science fiction, or you and I've got the superhero universes?
Yeah, Tim doesn't have a superhero universe.
How do you feel about guys in capes and tights?
That is a leading question.
I will back up one question from this. I have not done superhero stuff, but I have actually been thinking. In fact, I was going to talk about it to my wife and son this weekend. I did have an idea for a superhero type of thing. Don't have a story or anything, but I've got some idea.
Well, you know, we have that thing that we discussed about, I think it was either at Origins or at StellarCon a few years ago. We would have a multi-dimensional villain who might come into my universe and then come into Mike's universe and then come into your universe. And this was in a science fiction environment, mind you, not a superhero environment, but actually multi-dimensional villains lend themselves real well to superhero environments.
Yeah, I mean, either we create a villain that is, he's in his home dimension and is sending agents out into each of ours to create havoc.
Yeah.
And then we'd each send somebody forward to either send them laterally into each other's universes and then forward into his, or we all end up in his universe, our characters end up in his universe, and then take him on there.
I guess that's kind of a question. Would you all like to see us, you know, do something together, even if it's not Star Wars? Let's do something like this.
I would have to run the character past you guys, see if it's actually interesting or lame. But
nothing Timothy Zahn does can be lame.
That's
I'm
right.
Sorry.
Yeah. And that is the only way you can use lame and Timothy Zahn in a sense. Yeah, that's right.
Well, when you try, it comes out lame. And you're guys in tights again.
I'm game to discuss it. Sure.
Yeah.
So one
villain, three universes. He comes into each one, and in turn, our guys beat him back, and then follow him back where he's going.
We're talking about three novellas
in one book.
That's what we're talking about
now. Yeah. We'd basically be doing three novellas combined into one book, and then we'd have to figure out how we do the last section. Which we could do the way you and I did the Star Wars thing.
Okay.
Yeah. We plot the last section. We break it down into viewpoint chapters for each of our characters. Uh-huh. So in that last section, we'd each have at least one viewpoint character. We might have more than one character.
I have to apologize. We've just turned to a business discussion.
Yeah, sorry.
Feel free to talk among yourselves.
Don't mind us.
But actually, this is how the process works. We get together, and ideas bounce back and forth, and sometimes they're lame, but sometimes they work.
So we can easily do that, because our styles would mesh.
Because you got the In Hero Years, I'm Dead. I've got,
yep.
For those of you who are real old-line Champions players, I got the Star Wars, the Strike Force universe, and Mike and Timothy has the thing he's been working on.
Yeah.
And they'll probably all be very different characteristically, and that'll be even cooler.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because with the In Hero's Years I'm Dead, I get to figure out which era I want to play with.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because that would be fun.
All right.
And actually...
Well, I want to thank you all for help promoting this.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, we had breakfast with the Bain people today, and I found out that my next Cobra book, which I assumed was going to be scheduled for next fall, is going to be, February, March, April, May, sometime in 2015, so several months later, which means I actually have some space in my schedule.
Cool.
So this is
the way my schedule
this is now looking possible.
Yeah.
March. I'm thinking March, April, I ought to be open. And when is StellarCon? Are you going to go to StellarCon next year?
Not if they don't invite me.
It's an even-numbered year. Isn't it the year we're all supposed
to
go?
No, but they didn't invite us all last
year.
Yeah, so.
A different crew has taken over. Okay. They have no sense of history.
So you two will be invited this time, and I won't. Okay, yeah.
We'll just have to find another convention to love us.
What? Yes. Well, there's Origins.
I
think they're
going
to bring
Origins,
us all back.
Yeah. Origins is bringing us all back. That is
okay.
True.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm in charge of the budget. Origins is bringing us all back.
Didn't I title this Conspiracy for Fun and Profit? Yeah.
Can we get a business report next year when you come to DragonCon?
Just you'll wait for the Kickstarter.
Yeah. Oh, believe us, we'll announce the hell out of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We will.
So, yes.
Oh, God, will we?
Well, yeah, quick question on the mechanics. How long does it take once we turn the stories in to get it into ebook and print on demand or whatever?
Once we've got it finaled, we'd have to probably use someone like Jean Raby as an editor just to give it a once over, and I'm sure she'd be willing to do it. Once she hands a manuscript over to me. Question is, we want to get it illustrated. That's going to add about 2 to 4 weeks for illustrations. But once I've got all the pieces, we could have, once I get the pieces, it would take about 2 days maximum to do a PDF so that we'd be able to check it. So we'd be able to do a galley on the PDF. And then it would be 8 days after that's approved. That we would have physical copies.
So yeah, we're talking
generating good looking copy, for people to read. EPUB or a PDF is not very difficult.
Oh, so yeah, with artwork, we're talking 6 to 8 weeks tops.
Yeah.
So June.
And we could hire an artist to be doing stuff. Even off the rough drafts, if we just give them.
Don't do this at home. We are pros.
If we decide, let's say we wanted 6 illustrations, or let's say we've got 6 characters that we want illustrated, the villain, a couple of minions, and then the primary heroes we've got. You've got Denny. Getting the black and whites done. For that would be relatively simple and could be done while we're rough drafting stuff.
So theoretically, we've got till April to get the stories done.
Yeah, easy.
To get it by Origins.
To get it by Origins, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or we get it a little bit later, we'd have it here.
So. Origins.
You'll give us another. We'll have the publication. We'll have a publication party right here.
Right. I hope you all are tweeting this.
We have it recorded.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
It's on Twitter in print.
Yeah. Hashtag triple threat.
Triple threat. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Were you guys all friends before Star Wars collaboration, or did that? Because you guys seem like.
I'll tell you a little secret, a little known secret. In the early 1980s, Mike was a editor and writer for Flying Buffalo Incorporated, which is a game publisher. I was a writer and editor for Steve Jackson Games, and editor of their magazine, Space Gamer. And Timothy Zahn was selling fiction to us.
Well, to you, I don't think I ever sold
anything. No, you didn't
say
that.
Well, sold us at Space Gamer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've known each other at least through correspondence since about 1980, 81. Mike and I met on a horrifying road trip from our respective cities to Origins 1982 in Baltimore, Maryland.
We met at a truck stop in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, that's right. Where we had chicken fried steak.
Chicken fried steak was, we're driving cross country, to get, because I think the convention was in Baltimore, wasn't it?
Yeah, Baltimore.
And it got to the point where I had decided early on in the trip from Phoenix, and we had guys who were down from San Francisco. We were Hero Games, Flying Buffalo, and then Steve Jackson Games, we were all going cross country. I had decided that, and the only thing I was going to eat going cross country was chicken fried steak. That way, when we arrived at a restaurant, if I had to go use the bathroom or I had to go get gas or anything like that, someone else could order for me. Okay? And by the end of the trip, every male on the thing was ordering chicken fried steak. It was much simpler to do that than have to think.
No thinking involved.
Exactly.
And the women were looking at us horrified.
They were. But then again, it's truck stops. That's about the only thing that won't kill you.
But Mike was also selling fiction to Space Gamer. He had a series about a ground effects vehicle pilot and his pet Ogre, which is a gigantic cybernetic tank. And Tim sold us stories about a warrior in a fantasy environment whose talking sword was smarter than he was.
Yeah.
And that was really how we got to know each other professionally. And yeah. So yeah, that's been more than 30 years. Yeah.
But I mean, I had the contact with them, but none of this really started going until Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, I knew a lot of authors, but I didn't socialize with a lot of authors. I mean, meet them at conventions and, you know, hi,
and
how
having,
are you?
Having socialized with us now, you realize that was the originally the good choice.
It was really, yeah. But,
yeah.
But you know, there are writers who their job is their life, and that's not the way it is with me. So, you know, happy to meet them and chat and such in mail or online, everything, or at conventions, but I don't hang out with writers when, you know, I'm off duty type of thing. So it was when, I think, CoastCon?
What, yeah.
No,
it was on the panhandle of Florida, and I forget what because the place where it was
Huracan.
Was Huracan.
Or I think it was Huracan.
Which 2 years later was wiped off the map. I have to say, okay, Huracan, right? This is really important. I met Tim, we chatted a little bit, but where I really got to chat with him a bunch was while we were waiting at 5 o'clock in the morning for a shuttle to take us to the airport so we can fly out. So we get on the shuttle along with the flight crew of our plane. So I think it was like flying us to Atlanta, and then we were splitting up to go from wherever. We get to the airport, the flight crew gets off, and the driver looks at us and says, "Hey, guys, it's $20 a piece for this ride." And, you know, we're like, what?
We had been told the convention's picking this up.
Right. And I'm sitting there going, great, I don't think I've got $20 on me. You know, this is... I'm a writer, after all. You know, really.
We get paid in issues. You know.
And Tim was great. He took the driver's cell phone. He called, woke up the chairman of the convention and says, "This is Tim Zond. Here we are at the airport. You're taking care of this, aren't you?" And he hands the phone to the driver, and that was it.
I think this is the convention where I wound up being delayed and rescheduled on the flight two or three times, wound up on a red eye. I was keeping them informed the whole way of the new schedule. This is the new schedule. Got there at like 8:30 in the morning, and there was no one there to pick me up. So I think it deserved to get wiped off the map.
Literally, that hotel is not there anymore. It is one big sand dune. It's incredible.
So, questions. So,
questions, yes. Comments, observations, yeah.
And speak loudly. Oh, you've got a microphone.
There we go, we got a
even
microphone,
better.
Okay. To get a little bit off the top of collaboration, now that you guys don't answer to Lucasfilm anymore, per se, or George Lucas.
Not unless they waive money, yeah.
Right. I wanted to know what your guys' opinion is on why George Lucas thought we'd rather see Jar Jar Binks in the Trade Federation than, you know, Grand Admiral Thrawn and Mara Jade.
Well, I think
in film.
There are a couple of reasons there. And the first one is, and this is really important, this is really significant, the owners of an intellectual property that has gone from movies to books do not want to be, for the movies to be bound by the books. The movies have an audience in the multiple millions, and the books have audiences in the multiple tens or hundreds of thousands. There's a quantum leap of scale there, and so they don't want to be bound by us. We usually think that we're better writers, but they know how to sustain the financial return of an intellectual property across the span of movies. So there is that. Also, what George Lucas was trying to do was build a new audience. A younger audience, people who were kids and coming into Star Wars for the first time, and that's really not what any of our books have been intended to do.
Yeah.
But
no.
I mean, it was the Thrawn trilogy that really spawned off, you know, the rest
expanded universe. So
yeah,
if any yes. set of books would have been made into movies, I would have think it would have been those.
The reality of what Aaron's talking about is true. Even with the sales of those books, which were fantastic, and you know, everybody here probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for Tim and what Tim's books did. Okay, I mean that's just you know.
Yeah, really. Thank you.
But as much as people were saying that the universe was dead at that point, the fact is, and what we all forget, is that the videotapes of those movies were selling and selling and selling and being watched over and over and over again. When I did the X-Wing books, the assumption was, and I literally had a phone conversation and I was told this, that I ought to include Wedge Antilles because they thought that with Wedge Antilles I would probably pick up 30 or 40,000 more fans. That was all they thought. When the first X-Wing book came out and had Wedge in it, it hit the New York Times bestseller list because no one realized how many Wedge fans there were out there. And those Wedge fans were not the product of the novels. Those Wedge fans were the product of the people having watched the videotapes, seeing this one character survive, which when you were in the theaters, you never would have noticed that. But after you watched those tapes 20 times, or the second set of the tapes that you bought 20 times, okay, you realize he's there. So even though it had appeared that the universe was dead, fandom was still being built. People were sharing those films via videotape with their children and with people who hadn't seen them before. So that audience was primed, you know, and that's why the books have done really, really well. So it is the movies that are the big dog.
Yeah.
They are the lead dog on this sled. Sure, we're helping pull the load, but that is the lead dog, and the driver who controls the lead dog, and that determines where we go. And that is just the way it is.
And as was mentioned, Lucas is aiming for the younger audience. That's why Anakin is 9, and Jar Jar is kind of fits in with that kind of a mindset. Now, he could have layered it. He could have had Jar Jar grow as a person and still be a klutz. And we could have appreciated it the way Han grew in, you know, the character arc in A New Hope. He is all out for himself, but I will stick around just in case they need me. You could have done something like that with Jar Jar and satisfied us a little bit more. It wasn't what George was going for. Now that Kathleen Kennedy's in charge, we don't know what's going to happen. But I think one of your points has been that we hope that a lot of the people working at Disney and the younger folk at Lucasfilm grew up on our books. So we have hopes.
Yeah.
So my question in terms of collaboration is, in Tales of the Empire, you guys had your Korn and Thrawn kind of four chapter, two a piece crossover. I wonder if you can talk about the inception, the creation process, whether it was just phone calls back and forth, or whether you guys kind of sat around a table and started playing Go Fish and figured out like what was going on.
It was basically, we would talk mostly on the phone. You know, we lived too far apart for the Go Fish games. But it was mostly phone conversations. We would work out the basics. Then what I would typically do is write out an outline for the four sections, very heavy on details on sections 1 and 4, because those were the ones I would do. Very light on anything except this is where you need to start, this is where you need to end for Mike, and then play around with everything else. I mean, it was you're going from Atlanta to Tampa. The route is up to you.
Yeah.
And any details that we had talked about for those sections, I'd throw those in as well.
Right.
And so I would write part 1, then he would write 2 and 3, and I would make sure I'd wait until he'd finished 3, because if he came up with something better or a little bit tweaked, I didn't want to have to tweak an already written part 4 to match it. It's better just to follow the flow and then finish it off from there. So that was the pattern we did on, what did we do, 2 of those?
We did 2 of those.
Yeah. And part of the great fun of that, between that and was the missed encounter story, the finding of Thrawn out on the other world by Park, I think it was Captain Park. Between the the one of the collaborations, and that I got to use two of Mike's characters before he got to. I got to introduce Booster Tarek, and because I did part one of the story, I got to introduce Hal Horn.
That's right. So yeah, so his so you know he's the father of all characters that are good in Star Wars. And I have to say, you know, the fun thing about doing those collaborations, and you know, by the time I was writing Thrawn, because it was set in the past, you know, the Thrawn trilogy was already out. Thrawn was already gone. But just is a stunning and amazing character. And I remember when I was writing that, you know, the fun about doing that particular story is Thrawn's in disguise, Corran is in disguise, and you already, you know, we already know from reading those books what are the little things that Thrawn will pick up on. And I know, you know, I know Corran, and I know what Corran will pick up on. And it was, and the key to Thrawn was, I twigged on it. It was Thrawn is always one step ahead of everybody, and so once I had that, I knew Thrawn was going to be ahead of Corran, and that's fine. But I also knew because Thrawn is somebody who thinks so quickly and gets so much data in that innocuous data thrown out is going to be something he's going to take into contemplation. So, you know, he gets extraneous data and is making a slightly different pattern, which is probably what saved Corran's life in you know, in doing that situation. But then it was also funny in, or at least for me, it was fun in Isard's Revenge, which happens, the opening chapter of Isard's Revenge happens at the battle where Thrawn is done away with. There's Corran's in the cockpit, and Corran makes a momentary thing of wondering about Thrawn and what it would have been like to have ever met him and to deal yeah. with him, not realizing, of course, that the two of yeah. them actually spent a fair amount of time together. So
the idea of when the reader knows something the characters don't is a lot of fun to play with. And I think my favorite part of that was the artwork discussion.
Yes,
you quote those if you can remember those lines in that story.
I can't remember that. Someone out here probably does know those lines. You know, think of it, but I can't remember them. But it was just the idea that Corran, who is supposed to be, you know, a low-level individual, makes some art remark, and Thrawn is so into art, it's like, whoa, extraneous data coming out of this person. He's obviously not what he seems to be. Okay, so Thrawn has got to be watching what goes on, yeah. and so that was just a lot of fun.
Burning the art of the guy at the village.
Something like, yeah, I think it was their, you know, how much... something about, you know, what would it take to kill him or something, or not enough. There was some kind of line. Wonderful dialogue in that section. So
yeah, and that was so much fun to write, because I knew that Tim would be tickled. I was certainly being tickled, and by extension, I knew that the readers would be tickled, because they would know what's really going on here, even though the two characters.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, these two, not to be arrogant about it, but I mean, just these two great characters out of the universe are coming together, and they don't realize that it's each other, you know.
Yeah.
And if they did, they both would have pulled blasters and tried to kill each other, and the universe would have been totally rewritten in a different way. But you know, as it was, that's just how it worked out.
So it's definitely really cool to see how well you guys work together. I was wondering, on the collaboration side, could you expound a little bit on how collaboration goes with some of the other authors in the Star Wars universe, especially in the extended universe, when it comes to sort of, do you maintain a sense of sort of propriety of some of these characters as they get used by other authors, like later down the line, like when Wedge is, you know, now a general and things like that further down the line?
The answer is yes and no. It's really not all that simple. The last three series I worked in which, and that includes New Jedi Order, which Mike worked in, there has been a substantial effort for the writers to cooperate and collaborate, and this usually manifests itself in a couple of different ways. When a series is being set up, there is what is referred to as a story conference, meaning that a few of us get a free short vacation at one of the Skywalker facilities in California, where we get together and we hash out some of the details of the upcoming series. I was not involved in the one for New Jedi Order, but was with the two for Legacy of the Force and Fate of the Jedi. And then at midway points through the series, there tend to be other gatherings at other conventions or sites. We've done them at San Diego Comic-Con, especially in Celebration. Writers get together with Lucasfilm staff, with Del Rey staff, with writers who aren't involved in the series but are valuable resources, like James Luceno, who is a walking, talking encyclopedia of Star Wars. All of these people involved, and guys like Pablo Hidalgo and Leland Chi, who are walking, talking encyclopedia of Star Wars. But in the long stretches of time in between those, the writers and the principal editors and continuity people who are involved with the series exchange massive, massive amounts of email. The phone won't handle it anymore, and the internet has grown beyond the smoke signals that were being used by Mike and Tim back in the day. And so we'd have exchanges of emails that might be 100 messages back and forth in the course of a day. As we hash out minute or major plot points, after the first story conference, we'd go to our respective corners and hammer out some outlines, exchange those, and send them to Lucasfilm and Del Rey for approval, and then get to the process of writing, and then exchange massive amounts of email to make sure that the details are coherent and we're not treading too heavily on one another's characters. Now, of course, the question of treading too heavily on one another's characters, it didn't always work. I mean, Tim's characters got trod on pretty heavily. Not just Mara Jade, but Gilad Pelion and so forth and so on.
We refer to that as an out-of-character experience.
Out-of-character experience, that's right. Other characters were handled with more deft, kid gloves, especially if the writers involved were still active working on projects at the time. And that is an unfortunate side effect of the way things were being done. But wherever possible, the writers would accommodate one another in their wishes and perspectives on the way the characters should be utilized. And sometimes it turned out not to be possible. Because in some cases, the writers had gaffiated well out of the Star Wars universe. I used a Barbara Hambly character and killed him in the course of my New Jedi Order stories. I was not able to get in touch with her because the change to the Hambly character took place at the last minute because the character I had originally chosen was disallowed. And so I had to make the substitution, and bang, it was a new guy, and bang, I killed him, and then only later on tracked her down in a convention and said, "I'm sorry, this is why this happened." And she said, "Oh, that's fine."
That reminds me, for this collaboration, we ought to, we'll log the emails. And for the Kickstarter, we can make transcripts of how we're developing stuff available as part of the project.
Okay.
Good point.
That being said, when it's not a series like New Jedi Order or Fate of the Jedi, all bets are off. If it's just individual authors, whether they talk to each other depends very much on the social interactions. Mike and I talked a lot about stuff. I never talked to Barbara Hambly about any of my characters or anything of that sort. Kathy Tyers, when she did an NJO book, sent me a copy of the manuscript. Again, pre-internet, smokescreen days, sent me a copy of her manuscript with all of Mara's scenes tabbed. So if I didn't have time to read the whole book, I could at least see if she'd gotten Mara right.
Yeah.
But other characters, other writers have not talked to me. Mara's fate was not told to me in advance or during the writing or until about 2 months before the book came out. Yeah. And Aaron probably remembers more about more of the background of all that.
Yeah.
But
I've had kind of an uncomfortable relationship with Mara, starting with New Jedi Order. And part of that was because of writers who came before me. Mara was not quite herself in the New Jedi Order for a long period of time. And then she was handed off to me. And I said, well, I can either make her back into what she was with Tim, or I can account for the difference, or at least address the difference. And that's what we get back to actually following the arc of the psychology of the character. In the case of Mara, she had been behaving very oddly because of physiological changes to herself from an illness, and then what I must assume were hormonal and other changes that were brought on by her pregnancy. And suddenly she had, in the novel prior to mine, Ben had been kidnapped and restored to her, and I looked at what she had been up until that point and said, well, let's aim her back at the Timothy Zahn Mara. But what I had was a vision of Mara Jade as sort of a brooding raptor that had a chick that had been endangered, and she was not going to step away from that chick until that danger was alleviated. So she was still suffering an out-of-body experience, an out-of-character experience, but I was pointing her back in the direction of the real Mara Jade. So when people come to me and say, you got it wrong, I say, yes, I did.
But less
now look
wrong.
Where she was when I took her, and look where she was when I finished with her, and you'll see there's a direction there.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things sometimes you have to do when you're handling another writer's character. It's not easy, and you can't always do what amounts to the right thing instantaneously.
And again, I was completely out of the loop on any of that stuff. So nobody said, is this something that would happen tomorrow? Because if I had been in the loop, I probably could have found a way to keep her Mara, but still get the reaction, the actions, whatever, that they wanted. You see, I mean, that's part of the thing, is that's what drives you a little bit crazy when somebody uses one of the characters you created. You don't have to do this to them. I can get you what you want and still keep the person
in
character.
But it requires consultation.
Yeah.
You know, and not everybody was able to or willing to.
Yeah.
I think we are.
Well, let's just take time from somebody else.
That's right. There are three of us. Who's coming behind?
There are other panels. We would love to keep you guys here all the time.
Yeah.
Will you briefly tell everybody where they can see you the rest of the con?
Yes.
I don't know.
We'll whip out our badges here.
I know I'm on the schedule to appear at a panel tomorrow. I'm actually having a couple of little health issues. And so, with apologies, I'm not going to be in the What is Continuity panel tomorrow. I apologize. You might spot me in the lobby as I'm ready to go out to the airport, but really, as of now, I'm afraid I'm done for Dragon Con 2013.
Okay. Thank you for coming, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron. I think I do the Continuity panel in here tomorrow at 2:30, and I think that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm done.
Okay. I have a 10 o'clock panel tonight, Tripping the Light Fantastic, talking about out-of-the-box plotting. It's at the Embassy, D&F. 11:30 tomorrow, it's an Ask Me Anything in Centennial One with several other authors. And at 1 p.m. tomorrow, Writing Hard Science Fiction, Can You? In the Embassy, D through F. Also, shameless plug, speaking of Kickstarters, I am developing a 4X type, Master of Orion type game that will be using many of my aliens from other world, from other books as playable races. So we've got some promo cards here with magic codes on the back that will get you valuable prizes if this thing gets up and running. It gives you the website for the Kickstarter page. It's not active yet. Probably in a week or two it'll go active and we'll start actually seeing if you can fund it. But come grab as many as you want, as many as you've got friends for, as many as you want for enemies you want to see out of your life for a while they're playing a game. We got a ton of these things. I do not want to have to take them home. So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If you didn't get any before, or if you got some and wish you had more, we got plenty.
And I would like to say, on the subject of collaboration between the three of us, although this was not actually formally a collaboration, the three of us all appeared in short story or novelette format in a new anthology called Shadows of the New Sun, Stories in Honor of Gene Wolfe.
Yes.
And he became available just a couple of days ago. It is for sale, if there are any copies left, at Larry Smith Booksellers over at the Amerimart. We're all three in it. Mike and I are also appearing in the 5x5 anthology series, which is on sale at the Wordfire Press booth 203 over in the Amerimart.
So they're out of the one that I'm in.
Oh, they're out of,
yeah,
out of book
sold,
one?
Mine sold out.
In that case, you can get mine, which is volume two. But Shadows of the New Sun, it's also available online. But if you want all the three of us in one book, that's one place you can get it here. Yeah.
Okay, and before
there's your birthday dirge.
You're in trouble.
Awesome. So that's from Club Jade.
Thank you.
Paula.
Come up, get some cards, and take a piece of cookie.